Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. I hope your Saturday is treating you well. It's just gone 2:30 here on Premier Christian Radio. And another exciting edition of Unbelievable for you this afternoon as a Christian and non-Christian get together to talk. So welcome along, whether you're listening online via podcast or live this Saturday afternoon. It's great to have you with me. Don't forget that Dave and Bea are here with Hip Rock UK a little later on in the afternoon. But right now, it's time to look at questions concerning life, the universe, and everything. You're unbelievable. It's my pleasure to welcome into the studio this afternoon Nicholas Beale. He's co-authored a book with John Polkinghorne called Questions of Truth, and it's all about responses to questions about God, science, and belief. We'll be hearing a little bit about the book and why Nicholas put it together. He's going to be in conversation this afternoon with Julian Bagini. Julian is an atheist, and he's going to be explaining why he doesn't believe that Nicholas's explanations of why the universe points towards a creator God should be taken at face value. So that's what we're asking. Is the universe, its existence and its incredible apparent fine-tuning, is it evidence of a designer God? That's our question on Unbelievable this afternoon. Well, we look forward to that. I'm going to, in fact, give you a little kind of rundown of what the fine-tuning argument consists of in a moment. But first of all, some response to various emails that have been coming in. Thanks to all those who have got in touch recently after the last few programs. Earl Tate, who lives out in Moreno Valley, California, near Los Angeles, says, I listened to your broadcast with the John Lennox versus Richard Dawkins debate excerpt. I loved your show and program and was uplifted by what I heard. Keep up the good work for Christ. Thank you very much, Earl. That's obviously a program from last year. You can get to it via, as usual, the Premier Podcast Directory. Go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's where you can find the archive of Unbelievable shows. Listen online there or via podcast, or however you prefer. The options are all open to you. Don't forget, currently residing there is the podcast of last week. That was between Timothy Keller, pastor from New York, and Norman Backrack, an atheist. They were talking about the reason for God. We'll come to some of your responses to that in a moment. David Storm, I think that's how you pronounce your surname, David. Thanks for getting in touch. You say that you thoroughly enjoy the show, having recently found it and downloaded it as a podcast. You say, I guess I'd call myself a relaxed atheist. I find the philosophical and scientific arguments against the existence of God to be compelling, but I'm not dismissive of faith, never arrogant about my views, and always prepared to listen. One of my favourite quotes is from Bertrand Russell. The whole problem with the world is that fools and fanatics are so certain of themselves, but wiser people so full of doubts. I think there's wisdom in that, you say. And thank you very much for adding the Unbelievable podcast to your atheist directory. So thanks very much for doing that. And I would be very interested in getting the book that you've mentioned. This is interesting to me, David. You are an atheist, but you believe in the afterlife. That's not one I come across very often, I have to confess. You believe that actually there is a philosophical reason for believing in the afterlife, but it's got nothing to do with God. I would be interested to hear more. So thank you very much for getting in touch, David. Let's have some of your responses to last week's programme. We were really talking about morality, as we often like to do on this programme of late. It was Timothy Keller, author of The Reason for God, talking to Norm Backrack about how do we know what is right and wrong? Do we have to have, if you like, a divine lawgiver to know what's right and wrong, or can we explain it all simply by, you know, natural evolution? Got a lot of you writing in on this, actually. Nick Peters, a regular emailer, says, Norman stated his being open to issues on virtue of his being a humanist, really. Will he welcome the possibility of miracles? Would he welcome intelligent design as a possibility? Now, I, as a Christian, am open to new ideas as well, and realise if some ideas are true, then I have some that contradict them, then mine are false. But does Norman go to the Bible, though, and assume a priori that atheism is true and therefore there are no miracles, like he did at the end in his final statement, which Tim rightly caught? Does he go to science and assume a priori that nature is all there is? You go on to talk about the moral system that Norman outlined, utilitarianism. And there's all kinds of, as you go on to say, Nick, things that seem to make an absurdity of the whole idea of utilitarianism. If you're purely looking at it on the level of what produces the most pleasure for the most people, if you like. Thank you very much for those. We'll get to some more, but lots of atheists getting in touch with me about this as well. In fact, if you go to the Unbelievable group on the Premier Community, I started a thread on this very subject asking, is morality on an atheistic worldview essentially selfish, which is something that Tim Keller effectively pointed out. He said, you're jury-rigging self-centeredness by saying that you people should only do the right thing because it will benefit them, but that you should actually tackle that self-centeredness itself. That doesn't actually deal with the problem, if you like, of our self-centeredness. Does that mean that morality is essentially selfish, I asked. Here's some of the responses. Rational Ugandan says, hello, Justin. Thanks for the brilliant job you do on Unbelievable, which easily ranks as my favourite podcast. I'm from Uganda. Over the months that I've been listening to your programme, I've noticed that the moral argument for God's existence is clearly one of your favourite arguments for the existence of God. Whenever this particular subject is brought up on your show, you seem to quickly switch from being a moderator to an active proponent of the argument against whichever secular atheist guest might be in the studio at the time. Clearly you find it convincing. This week's programme was no exception as you joined Timothy Keller in actively trying to convince atheist Norman Backrack that without God there can be no objective morality. In my opinion, this is one of the weakest arguments for God's existence, and I wonder why Christian apologists love it so much. I feel that if one has a basic understanding of evolution by natural selection, this matter is quickly resolved. And you point me in the direction of a YouTube video. I watched the video. It still doesn't resolve my fundamental question about why we are obliged to do the right thing, however much we might be able to give a naturalistic explanation for the reasons that we do the right thing, why that is therefore the right. Anyway, I won't go into it now. This one from Trevor says, to answer your question with another question, are selfishness and generosity really so mutually exclusive? There are so many situations in life where we can work together in a win-win situation to simultaneously benefit ourselves and benefit other people. For example, I imagine a large proportion of the people will have enjoyable jobs in which they benefit others. Others will take great pleasure in hobbies that benefit other people. Do we not spend only a minority of our time doing things that are either purely selfish or purely beneficial? Thank you very much, Trevor. Just a few of the responses there on the thread that I've posted on the Unbelievable forum of the Premier Community. If you want to get involved yourself in the discussion, and probably, you know, there's a couple of good Christian apologists kind of making their mark there, but lots of atheists. So if you want to get involved, if you're into Christian apologetics, then do get involved there at premier.org.uk/unbelievable and click on the link through to the Premier Community. It'll take you to the Unbelievable group there. Chris in Whiteleaf says, I'm always amazed by the number of contradictions and inconsistencies that arise when atheists talk about their worldview. Last week's show was no exception. It was interesting to hear how your atheist guest argued for a material-only universe, and yet his very act of debating assumed the non-material laws of logic, thus refuting his own position from the very start. He then went on to state there are no absolutes, moral or otherwise. Once again, this is self-refuting. To claim there are no absolutes is to make an absolute statement. Atheism is a non-physical belief system, but teaches that only the physical exists. It cannot account for logic, truth, beauty, justice, or ethics, all of which transcend the material world. only the transcendent, non-physical and unchanging Almighty God can account for the non-physical universe and unchanging laws of logic and the values that make human experience meaningful. Thank you very much, Chris. Thanks for everyone who's got in touch about last week's programme. Again, if you want to hear Timothy Keller, a very astute debate between Timothy Keller and Norman Backrack, an atheist, do visit last week's programme at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And you can find this programme there as a podcast as well. So do check that out. Okay, I think it's time to just give you a taster of what's coming up with my guests today. They are Nicholas Beale and Julian Baggini. We're asking, does the fine-tuning of the universe mean that it must have been designed? What is the fine-tuning argument? Okay, let me do this for you. And I think we need some appropriate music.
Space, the final frontier.
Ah, yes, that's better. Okay, right. Well, I'm going to borrow a little bit from the website reasonablefaith.org, which is the website of William Lane Craig. And he puts it quite well here, some of the figures that are involved with why the universe is so fine-tuned. For example, he says, the physicist P.C.W. Davis has calculated that a change in the strength of gravity or of the atomic weak force by only one part in 10 to the 100 would have prevented a life-limiting universe. The cosmological constant which drives the inflation of the universe and is responsible for the recently discovered acceleration of the universe's expansion is inexplicably fine-tuned to around one part in 10 to the 120. Roger Penrose of Oxford University has calculated that the odds of the Big Bang's low entropy condition existing by chance are on the order of 1 out of 10 to the 10 brackets, 1, 2, 3 close brackets. Penrose comments, I cannot even recall seeing anything else in physics whose accuracy is known to approach even remotely a figure like that one. What it boils down to is the odds of this happening by chance are just, well, they're not even astronomical, because it's like, I've heard it said that the fine-tuning, the fact that it got spot on for our unit to be just the right conditions for our universe to produce life is like shooting a rifle from one end of the universe and it hitting a penny on the other side of the universe dead in the middle. I mean, and even that doesn't really do it justice. So this is what we're talking about, the incredible unlikeliness of our universe. Did the universe see us coming? Was it designed by God? That's what we're asking on Unbelievable this afternoon. Well, welcome along to the programme, and I hope you've got your brain in gear this afternoon, because we're going to be looking at various scientific theories, and particularly around the universe, the Big Bang, how did the universe get started, all that sort of thing, are among many questions addressed in Questions of Truth. It's a book by John Polkinghorne and Nicholas Beale, and Nicholas is with me in the studio this afternoon. He's a Christian, and the book really aims to address various questions about God, science, and belief. But this is, of course, the show where Christians and non-Christians talk. Julian Baggini is an atheist and editor of the Philosopher's Magazine, and published, actually, you had a review in the newspaper recently, didn't you, Julian? Yeah. Of this book. So we'll hear some of your criticisms of the book, as well as where you feel perhaps, you know, that there is useful stuff in there as well. So those are our guests this afternoon. I do hope you can stick around, whether you're listening online or live this Saturday afternoon. You're very welcome to this conversation. Well, let's perhaps start with you, Nicholas. First of all, tell me a little bit of your background. You are scientific, obviously, in some degree, but did you train as a scientist?
Well, I read mathematics at Cambridge as an undergraduate, and that's where I first met my co-author, John Polkinghorne, who was professor of mathematical physics at the time. I then became a computer scientist and worked on computer communications, then got involved in business strategy. But also, John invited me to join the committee that advised is the Church of England on science, medicine and technology. So I got to know him a bit better then. And for the last 10 years, one of the things I've been doing in my abundant spare time has been running this little website, polkinghorne.net, where people send questions from all over the world about science and religion. Recently, in fact, in my professional work, I've been collaborating with Martin Novak, who is a brilliant professor at Harvard. He's a professor of biology and of mathematics and one of the leading developers of evolutionary dynamics. So rather to my astonishment, I am doing some quite leading-edge scientific stuff in applying certain areas of evolutionary theory. But in general, I'm the exact opposite of an academic. Academics know an awful lot about something.
Whereas you know a bit about many things. Is that the idea?
Yes, that's and that's coming quite handy for this book, because we fearlessly range over a very wide set of scientific disciplines, although we've been lucky to have extraordinarily able specialists who've been able to check things so that, for example, what we have to say about anthropic fine-tuning, Martin Rees has been very kind enough to look at it, and the material, some of the very specific material, another very good cosmologist, Joe Silk, helped us with. So it's I mean, there are lots of things you have to slightly skate over, even in appendices, but it's nice to know that you've got experts who've checked some of it. All the mistakes are mine, but a lot of the smart stuff is theirs, if you see what I mean.
I mean, inevitably, it's not a very thick book, so you've obviously had to deal with the questions, 51 of them, relatively quickly, briefly, and I suppose it's then down to the individual if they want to look further to follow up the sources, etc. I mean, but John Polkinghorne has a long time been a very good physicist, but he's obviously been known for the fact that he marries that with his Christian faith. I mean, what do you feel has been John's real contribution to the area of physics and faith?
Well, he's written 26 books on science and religion, of which this is the 26th. I think it started just trying to explain to his former colleagues in physics why he wasn't in any sense committing intellectual suicide when at the age of 50 he resigned his professorship and he was head of particle physics in the applied mathematics department at Cambridge to train as a priest. One of the very important things that he's done is that he was instrumental in setting up the International Society for the Study of Science and Religion, which is an international learned society bringing together people from all kinds of different religious backgrounds who are seriously studying the interaction of science and religion. And also, because he's so well respected in the physics and in the scientific community, he's been, I think, a very important bridge builder. People are willing to listen to someone with such strong scientific credentials in a way that they might be less willing to listen to somebody like me, for example.
Julian, thank you for being on the programme today. Tell us a little bit about your background. Did you ever have any kind of religious belief, or would you say you've always felt like an atheist?
No, not at all. I grew up assuming God existed. I went to a Catholic primary school, and when I went to secondary school and found it was less religious, and basically this thing happens in Britain which religion just vanishes, bothered me a bit. I thought, well, surely if God exists, this is one of the most important things for us to know. So I kind of persisted with that myself. I actually ended up going to a Methodist church via a youth club.
Really?
So I was a Christian all through my teenage years, really, and sort of gradually lost my faith, I guess, between the ages of about 16 and 18, I would say.
And you, that wasn't particularly for philosophical reasons, or did it come down to some kind of...
Well, it's very broad. I think it's very broadly philosophical reasons, really. You know, I kind of just didn't find good answers to the doubting questions I had. You know, people always have these questions, I think. And, you know, when I sometimes spoke to some of the ministers and asked them things, I found the replies are quite lame. I mean, one of the things that actually was quite instrumental for me was I did religious studies A-level, where we studied... Well, it was actually quite a conservative syllabus then. We did modern church history and St. John's Gospel. And after a very short while of studying John's Gospel, I certainly lost any illusion that it was, you know, the dictated word of God, let's put it that way. So, I mean, in a weird way, religious studies with a Christian teacher was a contribution to me losing my faith, quite ironic.
That is somewhat ironic. But you've gone on, presumably, you're the editor now of the Philosopher's Magazine. What does that mean? I mean, do you find that most philosophers you do come into contact with have a kind of an atheist outlook?
Yeah, I think so. It's a pretty atheist profession, but then academia is as a whole as well. I'm not sure quite what the differences in proportion are, but certainly we did a little survey a few years back and found that about, you know, three quarters at least of philosophy lecturers in Britain and the UK who took part in the survey, it wasn't exhaustive, were, you know, non-believers, complete non-believers, didn't believe in any kind of personal God whatsoever. It is quite typical. And there are other sciences are interesting as well. I know that people argue about what these surveys show, and it does vary from discipline to discipline. But I certainly think as academic biologists, for example, there's a very high degrees of godlessness, much more than the population as a whole.
Hmm. Well, we're talking about science today, but of course that does interact with philosophy. And I mean, do you have to be fairly up on the science to be able to talk about whether God could be a viable cause for the existence of the universe? And
I don't think you do. I mean, apart from anything, with any of these issues, as individuals, we have to make our own choices. And we're always called upon to make our best judgments of things where we don't know the specialist detail. But I think we'll find, and hopefully our conversation will bear this out, that a lot of the general things you need to understand in order to assess these cases are not technical. There's a lot of highly technical stuff, particularly in the appendices of Nicholas's book, which, you know, are very interesting, and clearly, you know, they know their science a hell of a lot more than I do, if you'll forgive the expression. But at the same time, you know, we know that scientists disagree amongst themselves about these matters. Having a specialist knowledge does not lead you inevitably one way or the other. So we can't just defer to the experts because they disagree. So everyone has to sort of think it through for their own.
Well, thank you both for being with me. I look forward to the discussion. If you're listening, then we are going to be talking about things like the anthropic principle, the fine-tuning of the universe that physics appears to have, if you like, discovered in the last couple of decades, that the universe we inhabit is fantastically, if you like, almost appears to be set up for human life to be able to exist. Does that suggest that there is a fine-tuner out there? There is a God who is, if you like, behind the very design that we see in the universe around us? And what about the very existence of the universe? Does the fact that there is something there mean that there must have been a cause for its existence? Can something come from nothing? Is that what atheists believe? We'll find out what Julian has to say about that. So we're going really back to the fundamentals, I suppose, of the universe. We probably won't so much talk about other issues that do exist around evolution and creation and that kind of thing. There's plenty of other unbelievable episodes if you want to investigate those kinds of issues. But I'm looking forward to this as we really look at some of these aspects of whether the universe has the hallmarks of being designed, and whether God is an adequate explanation for that. So do join us again in a short moment, and we'll continue looking at this subject here on the programme.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
That gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back. We're looking at the universe. How did it come to be? And is God the best explanation for it? That's one among a number of issues that are tackled in the book Questions of Truth. It's just been published and it's available, I believe, through Alban Books in the UK. Nicholas Beale is the co-author along with John Polkinghorne. And they've been responding to people's questions about God, science and belief for a long time. And this book really is the fruit of those responses. Well, Julian Bergini is an atheist. He's the editor of the Philosopher's Magazine, and he's come in to discuss with Nicholas some of the results of the book, some of the answers that Nicholas and John give to various questions about science, God and faith. So we're going to dive right in at the deep end because this really could get very scientific at this point, but I hope that you, Nicholas, you'll kind of guide us through this in fairly layman's terms, just for my sake, if no one else is, and just explain from the outset why you believe that there is a case for saying that what we know of the universe suggests that there is a God.
Well, let's start by describing what seems to be pretty uncontroversial. In the standard scientific understanding of the universe that we have at the moment, there are some basic scientific laws, of course, but there are a number of fundamental constants, like the ratio of the strength of gravity to the strength of the electric force, for example. And what people began to discover a few decades ago was that these fundamental constants, which have particular values, but there's no obvious reason why they should have one value rather than another. These particular values are extraordinarily sensitively tuned, if you like, to allow for the possibility of some kind of intelligent life developing somewhere in the universe. A lot of this has got to do with carbon. There are pretty good reasons for thinking that without carbon, it would be very, very difficult to have very complex organic life forms. And it turns out that if you tweak to some of these fundamental constants, even by a very small amount, then you'd have universes which wouldn't have any carbon at all, or you might have universes which just didn't last long enough for evolutionary processes to have happened. A lot of it's explained very well in Martin Rees's brilliant book, Just Six Numbers, and there's also someone called Paul Davis who's written a Goldilocks Enigma, similar kind of idea. Now, what pretty much everybody agrees is that if this is the only universe there is, and if these constants are, you know, just the way they are, then there's something very odd going on. Therefore, a lot of cosmologists think, well, there must be zillions of other universes, because if there were enough other universes, then it'd be much more reasonable to say, well, you know, you just good luck, you happen to be in the universe where life is. Well, this is what the so-called multiverse is about. It's not quite true to say that multiverse has been invented simply to get around fine-tuning. There are some motivations that make one think it might not be completely unreasonable, but on the other hand, it's a slightly odd idea that says, well, because this universe has got very special features, we will hypothesise some enormous number of other universes. I won't even say astronomical. The sort of numbers that are talked about are maybe 10 to the 200. That's vastly more than the number of elementary particles there are in this universe, just in sort of in order to even out the odds. So the alternative is to say, well, maybe these peculiar fundamental constants are there for a reason. And, of course, if you begin to entertain the idea that there is a loving ultimate creator, then it's kind of easy to understand what the reason for those constants might be. If you love, then, you know, you want to create people whom you can love. And these constants are exactly tuned for the possibility that somewhere in this vast universe, intelligent life can arrive. Of course, it doesn't mean to say that this intelligent life will have, you know, five fingers on each hand and so on and so forth. But you do at least have to have the conditions which allow persons, as we would say, to exist somewhere else in the universe.
You talk about this having really arisen in the last few decades. I mean, up to the point at which, you know, these fundamental constants started to become scientific knowledge and, you know, the theory of the Big Bang, etc., became the standard. I mean, had people kind of gone on the assumption that probably the universe had always been around in some sense and that therefore that there wasn't any need perhaps to recourse to some kind of creator God?
Oh, well, that's a slightly separate issue, although quite an interesting one. There was a lot of resistance to the idea of the Big Bang, some of it, quite frankly, on theological or rather atheological grounds. It's slightly unfortunate, perhaps, that the person who noticed that the Einstein equation had this solution for a Big Bang, Lemaître, was actually a Catholic priest. And a lot of cosmologists, Fred Hoyle famously was one of the leading people in this country, you know, thought that the idea of a Big Bang was suspiciously like creation. And it was only really when the cosmic background radiation was discovered quite accidentally that cosmologists gave up their opposition to this. But the anthropic fine-tuning is a somewhat different point. It was only when enough of the details of what's called the standard model of particle physics were worked out that you could begin that they could begin to ask the question, well, how would cosmology be different if these constants were slightly different? That they began to find this extraordinary thing that even small changes in the constants would make the emergence of life anywhere impossible. So it's really, as with so often with science, until you've got a good basic understanding of the theory, good enough to do calculations with, you can't really notice funny things about the numbers.
So for you, Nicholas, is a as you call it, a loving ultimate creator, the best explanation for this apparently fine-tuned universe? And multiverse explanations are actually more complicated in their way, or less have less explanatory power than your belief in a loving ultimate creator.
Yes, I think that's a fair summary. The problem with the multiverse explanations is not only is it bringing in this, you know, super astronomical number of other unknowable universes, but it raises quite serious philosophical problems. And even then, you still have the problem is, well, where does this multiverse come from? One of the principles in this book is that I suggest in this book is people often try and find an explanation for one of these funny numbers, why it should be how it is. And so far, all these explanations, it turns out that you can explain one of these numbers, but only at the expense of introducing two or more new numbers. Sometimes these explanations in the end make the problem more perplexing rather than less. I wouldn't say for a moment that the only reason to believe in God is anthropic fine-tuning. That would be ridiculous. After all, people have believed in God for a long time before they even knew there was this anthropic fine-tuning problem. And it may be that someone will come up with some new science which shows that instead of six very carefully fine-tuned numbers, there are only three or four. And the fine-tuning may not be so huge. But at the moment, on current science, for what's known, it looks a much more plausible explanation than 10 to the 200 other unknowable universes.
And from that point of view, the advances in science, much less than perhaps someone like Richard Dawkins would have us believe, have, rather than having disproved God, in fact, in this area, if anything, they've shored up belief in God.
I think something very interesting has been happening to science over the last few decades, and is clearly going to happen a lot more going forward, in that it's becoming much more integrative and much less reductionist. In other words, instead of simply chopping things up into smaller and smaller pieces, people are realising that you can't understand what's going on unless you have a good understanding of how the system as a whole relates to each other. And sometimes the details of the pieces aren't nearly so important as the overall system behaviour. So I think, to be fair to Dr. Dawkins, the sort of reductionist view that he pioneered in The Selfish Gene, and the same kind of quasi-reductionist approach that he takes in The God Delusion, although they're not, you know, scientifically at all exactly comparable, it's an attitude that's moved, that which science itself is moving away from. More and more of the interesting work in science is in figuring out how whole systems behave together, and they behave in rather surprising ways.
Well, let's bring Julian into this now, because you've laid out the ground well for us there, Nicholas, and I'd really like you gents really to go at it together, and I won't have to interrupt too much, but so feel free to, you know, just address each other. But what's, as a starting point, your reaction to what Nicholas has laid out for us there, Julian?
Well, I mean, there are so many things that could be said, but I think that the general thing and problem I have, I think, which is the biggest one, is this, that I think that if you want to argue that religious belief is compatible with science, then I don't think you're going to have too much problem, actually. Certain forms of religious belief aren't. You know, if you do believe that the Earth was created only 6,000 years ago and so forth, then, you know, you have to face the facts. You are going right against what science says. And Nicholas and John don't say that. They accept Big Bang, they accept evolution and all these things. But, you know, there are numerous forms of religious belief which accepts that even things like the Bible, which people can take to be in some sense sacred, are not historical in all their details, are reveal spiritual truths rather than, if you like, geological, historical or scientific ones and so forth. So that's all fine. But where I think there's something, I think there's a line there which is crossed a bit by John and Nicholas in this book, which is they actually, rather than just simply show that their religious belief is compatible with the science, they're trying to show that somehow the science, in a way, supports their belief and shores it up. Now, the reason I'm suspicious of this, and I think if I were a religious person, I'd be suspicious of this too, is that we know historically this has been a very popular thing. People have always pointed to the things which are not understood and used that space of mystery to place their god. In the most primitive versions of this, of course, are people who thought that, you know, the lightning and the thunder were the gods, you know, shining lights and banging drums or whatever it might be. But, you know, beyond that, there are people who we had no way of understanding how life came to be, and people thought, well, you know, best explanation of that, surely intelligent designer, someone who created them. You know, look at an eye, it's so intricate, it's so incredible. You know, if we look at a watch and we think a watch has been designed, then even more so an eye. And at the time, that did seem quite probable. But the problem was, it seemed probable because the human imagination basically couldn't foresee what science was later to show. So as far as the imaginations are concerned, this seemed the most likely thing. Now, I think we're in the same kind of place here. Now, the room of scientific mystery has been pushed right back to actually quite, you know, detailed things, obscure things at the beginning of time, at the Big Bang, the equations and so forth. And I'm a little bit worried that, you know, this is, again, what we're seeing is people are looking to where the science is still incomplete, perhaps will always be incomplete, where there's a bit of mystery there, and thinking, well, you know, I can't see a scientific explanation for this, but hang on. And then the explanation they come up with, again, is the best human imagination can do. You know, these figures look like they're very precise, so it looks like someone's programmed them in. I really don't think that's a very strong line of reasoning. And I think it leaves religious belief vulnerable to a future scientific explanation, which is going to, you know, perhaps explain these things away in less mysterious terms. So that's I think that's the biggest issue I have with it, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's interesting that the shift from what was previously supposed of steady-state universe to the Big Bang, which was a genuine scientific discovery, actually moved the scientific picture of the world back to something which was closer to the sort of standard religious picture than before. So these advances in science work both ways, but I absolutely accept that, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years' time, the, you know, there may, it may be that instead of six rather mysterious numbers, there are three or four. Or it may be that there turn out to be 60. Pauli, one of the great pioneers of quantum physics, used to say, no credits for the future. And we have to start, to some extent, with, you know, what we know. At the moment, it looks, you know, on the science that's understood, it looks as though the fine-tuning is a very, very big problem for, you know, that cries out for some kind of explanation. But whatever, you know, whatever theory there is can be about the universe. Any scientific theory is ultimately going to be expressed in terms of here are a set of natural laws and here are a set of boundary conditions or constants from which these natural laws operate. There will always have to be some kind of meta-scientific question, which is why those particular laws, why those particular constants, and why, what is it that breathes fire into the equations? So this isn't a question of sort of God of the gaps, because any conceivable science, there will always be these kind of questions that can be answered, or so that can be asked. And yeah. Atheists in general, you have to say, there is no answer. Well, the truth is, there is an answer. You might not agree with the answer, and you have reasons for disagreeing with the answer, which may or may not be good ones, but let's at least honestly admit that there is an answer sitting there.
Well, yeah, but the fact that there's an answer on the table doesn't mean one should take it. I mean,
no,
I think
absolutely,
let's agree
that there is an answer, which you may or may not want to accept, rather than, because a lot of your colleagues, not you personally, try this sort of trope of, oh, you know, there's no evidence for Christian belief, there's no, you know, it says nothing. That just isn't true. I mean, it's perfectly respectable to say there is insufficient evidence for me for Christian belief. Mm. That's a perfectly reasonable position. To say there is no evidence is completely unreasonable.
Well, I mean, to be honest, most of the people I know would say that it was insufficient or this overwhelming the other side. No is a kind of hyperbolic statement. Yeah. But I want to go back to this thing about, you know, what science leaves aside, because I think there's an important little distinction here. OK, first of all, there are all those questions which are left over once all the science is done. So you're right, we could have a complete science, if you like, and there would still be why questions left. You know, and in fact, you know, I mean, in the book you make this distinction that science is about the how, but there are still those other why questions which you reserve for theology. Now, that's fine, but it seems to me that when you're proposing that Creator God is the best explanation for this fine-tuning, that's not trying to answer a question which is always going to be left over, no matter how advanced the science is. That is trying to answer a question which is currently internal to science. And I think that's why I think it is still a kind of God of the gaps type argument.
Again, I think I want to come back to the point that wherever we get to with science, there will always be natural laws and there will always be boundary conditions or constants. Now, at present, with the current understanding of science, the set of natural laws we have and the set of boundary conditions and constants do raise this anthropic fine-tuning very heavily. But any conceivable set of natural laws and boundary conditions will raise that issue to a greater or lesser extent. It is a why issue. It's not a how issue. Mm. And yes, the Goldilocks problem, if you like, might get better or might get worse with future scientific developments. But it'll always be there.
Yes, but I think the point is you're making the fact that the particular number seems to be particularly improbable as a specific reason for thinking that the Creator God is the best explanation. Whereas, actually, I think, you know, no, as you say, no matter what the numbers are, no matter how things work out, then you get the why question. So I think it's this blurring of the boundaries between what is the theological or metaphysical question of what sets the boundaries, what sets the laws in the first place, and how we actually work out, you know, why within the operation of the universe these laws are the way they are. And, you know, and the problem, and I mean, my appropriate answer to that is I think that, you know, there are all sorts of things at any stage in science. There are always things which are just not known to current science. And I do think the best thing to do then is to reserve judgment. And I do think that there's a certain irony that I often get here, religious people accuse atheists of being sort of like overly materialistic people who have no sense of mystery. Yeah. And yet, actually, I think a lot of the time atheists have more of a willingness to accept the mystery in the sense that they accept there are things about the universe we don't understand yet and how they work. And it's rather a lot of the time religious people who fail to leave a mystery lie. And wherever they see a mystery, they kind of see their God.
Fascinating stuff. Well, if you want to get in contact over anything you've heard on the programme today so far, do remember the email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can phone your comment through and leave a voicemail on 08456 52 52 52, select option 5. Don't forget as well, you can listen back to this programme at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As far as I can see, Julian, presumably you do believe that obviously the universe exists, yeah. and therefore does your mind leap to there must be an ultimate explanation for it, but that explanation can't involve God because you're an atheist, therefore God is kind of ruled out from the start.
No, I don't rule it out from the start. As I said, I was actually religious in my youth. I don't rule it out. But I just think, you know, these things are probably beyond us. I think science does its best to get as far down that road as possible. The evidence for religion, such as it is, I think, is of a rather different order. Most people's belief in a loving creator God, they may find it reassuring to read a book like this and discover that their belief is entirely compatible with science. But it's not science that leads them to it. Most of the time, it's a personal conviction. It's a belief that one has had a direct experience of God's grace and so forth. So, you know, I think that the reasons why people have for being religious are really nothing to do with this. And I just keep an open mind about these things. Of course, I ask the questions, but I think
I'm not open enough to go to the possibility that it is a loving ultimate creator.
Well, there's a possibility. Of course there's a possibility. Of course I'm open to that possibility. Mm. I mean, yeah, this is the thing. Atheists often accuse of being dogmatic. But they're not. That atheist bus slogan, which was flawed in some ways, got something right. It said there's probably no God, you know? The right kind of atheism is one which is based on where we think the balance of evidence is. Of course I could be wrong. Absolutely I could be wrong.
What do you say then, Nicholas? Because are Christians guilty then of, in a sense, wherever there is mystery, wherever there is an unknown, they thrust in their God of the gaps? I mean, I think you're very keen, along with John, to reject anything that comes across as God of the gaps sort of theory. I mean, you very much dismiss aspects of intelligent design, which you see as doing that, you know, which kind of try and suggest that the evolutionary process doesn't work in some way or another. And that's been accused of a sort of God of the gaps kind of mentality. But on this ultimate question of this anthropic principle of the universe, why doesn't this count as a God of the gaps? Why must God be the ultimate explanation in this case, rather than any other explanation, even if we don't know of it yet?
Well, could I just say, well, rather than simply saying this is one of those things where we have to just reserve judgment?
Yes, I don't think that, as you say, anyone believes in God simply because of this anthropic fine-tuning business. So what you're actually finding, as you do with any, and you're comparing any two or more worldviews, you've got a set of observations which have an interpretation in one worldview, and if you want to be slightly technical about it, have a sort of likelihood of occurring given this worldview. Yeah. And then you can think about the alternative worldview and how likely are those things to have occurred. And from a Christian worldview, you know, there are therefore some fairly clear explanations for these puzzling things. But we're not saying that God only acts in the areas where science doesn't understand. I mean, we think that the laws of science actually come from God. So one of the objections that John Polkinghorne has to this intelligent design, he says there's a scientific mistake involved. There's also a theological mistake of imagining that God doesn't act through his own laws. You know, even in you know, human terms, a wise ruler acts through laws that they make. They may also act in other ways. And it's been, in fact, a tremendous gift of science to theology, an evolutionary understanding of the universe, which has helped explain from a theological point of view some very puzzling things about the universe, like why it's so big, for example, but also helps address this extraordinary conundrum for theology, which is how on earth can an omnipotent God create a creation in which there's genuine freedom? And the answer seems to be by allowing this creation to come into being through evolutionary processes, which have their own freedom, as it were, built in. But this isn't a God of the gaps. This is seeing from the starting point of a loving ultimate creator a sort of a deeper understanding of pretty much everything that we know about science. Not nullifying it, but helping it make sense in a bigger picture.
Well, when I would talk about the God of the Gaps, I wouldn't say that was what your God is on all occasions that you invoke him. I mean, I'm talking specifically about the function in explaining fine-tuning. But you said something interesting, Nicholas Hirsch, I think is a really important issue, which is you were talking about how we come to these issues from a certain broader worldview.
Yeah.
And you say you come to this with your Christian worldview, other people may come to it with an agnostic or an atheist worldview. And I think this is one of the very tricky, philosophically tricky and very interesting things, because it is inevitably the case, I think, that people can and do interpret the evidence they see according to the other assumptions they have. Now, the problem with that line of thought is it could lead you to a tremendous scepticism. It could make you think, well, how on earth are we ever going to see things truly as they are? We all bring our biases to things. I don't think we need to be quite that sceptical, but I think what we need to do is always be aware of the extent to which other beliefs we have are going to motivate and change the way we interpret the evidence. And we have to just be very, very vigilant to try and filter those things out. Now, in this case, I would say, you know, what can we do about this? I have my worldview, you have yours. How can we, as best we can, ask the question, what sense would people make of this who didn't have commitments which were going to push them one way or another? And I have to say, I do think that at best, that's the best case on your side, at most, someone who's neutral about this, who approached it, might conclude from all this fine-tuning that you have to have some initial design or purpose there. But that would be very, very, very far removed from anything like the kind of God who is worshipped, far removed from something as specific as the Christian God. And actually, we have a concrete example of this, actually. The atheist philosopher, formerly atheist philosopher Anthony Flew, has been a rather unseemly attempt to claim his soul recently on both sides. But, you know, it does seem he has changed his opinion. He is convinced by fine-tuning. But what he is convinced of is something which, again, is very far removed from theism. He is the deist view, essentially, that there is a kind of intelligent purpose behind the universe, but it's a kind of, it's not a personal being who we have a relationship with. It's something which set things up in the first place. And I think, you know, there's a huge gap between the most a kind of neutral scientific understanding of anthropic fine-tuning could take you towards God, and the actual God, which is believed by people who are seeking some kind of support from it.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll allow you to respond, Nicholas. Interesting stuff so far. You're listening to a discussion on the fine-tuning of the universe and whether it is evidence of a designer God. Two different views in the studio here, as I've been joined by Nicholas Beale, who's co-author of the recently released book Questions of Truth, worth getting hold of if you're into questions of God, science and belief. So we'll be coming back in a couple of minutes time as we continue to look at these questions of faith, God and science. Welcome back to the programme. Next week, I'm joined again by a Christian and an atheist. David Robertson is our Christian. He's a Christian pastor who has written a book called The Dawkins Letters. It's been a bestseller, and it basically dismantles what he calls atheist myths represented in The God Delusion, the bestseller by Richard Dawkins. He's going to be in conversation with Adrian Hayter, who runs an atheist blog. Find out more at the same time next week between 2:30 and 4.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back as we continue to talk about science, God, the Big Bang, all those sorts of questions which are addressed in Questions of Truth by John Polkinghorne and Nicholas Beale. Nicholas is with me in the studio, our Christian guest today. Our atheist guest is Julian Bagini. He's an editor of the Philosopher's Magazine and has written a review, not altogether unflattering by any means, but in which he particularly, though, does take issue with some of the answers that Nicholas gives to various questions about God and science. So just returning to what we were saying before the break, gentlemen, you were explaining, Julian, exactly why you feel that even if a neutral observer were to, you know, be persuaded to in the direction of Nicholas, it would only lead to a very deistic kind of belief at best. Nothing like the Christian God, the Trinitarian God, the God who became Jesus incarnate, etc. It's still quite a big leap, though, isn't it, to go from not believing in any cause, purpose, or anything beyond the material universe to believing there is something beyond it. I mean, I've always thought, in a way, if you're prepared to do that leap, I think the leap from that, from a deist God to believing in a personal God, is actually smaller for me than the leap from no God to a God.
Well, interesting. I interviewed Jonathan Sacks recently, the chief rabbi, and he said, you know, he's okay with deists. They're half the way there. Yeah. You know. I'm not sure about that, to be honest. But in a sense, that doesn't matter, because my point was simply that this is the furthest you could go with it. Actually, I don't think the case even leads you to deism. But that was the point. But it leads to huge problems. You know, if you think this science is supporting your particular kind of belief, then that is problematic. Because, of course, you know, the fact that there is a creator God, even if you think that's what the evidence points towards, still leaves you with all sorts of problems about the fact that over different times, different places in the world, people attribute very different qualities to this God. They worship different versions of him and so forth. So in a way, the most you've got is, I think, what you had in the first place anyway, which is that you have a kind of a space for God. You have a kind of an intellectual respectability about your belief in God. But, you know, I think that belief in God can be intellectually respectable. That's something where I'm different to some of my harder liners.
Sure.
So I don't think it really helps you a great deal.
I suppose it's at that point that you get into theology as opposed to just the pure sort of metaphysics of that we've been discussing so far, in a way. But Nicholas, I mean, is that a fair point, that the best you can ever achieve with your arguments from the science to God is a kind of deistic God? It'll never actually draw someone to believing what you actually believe about a personal, loving, ultimate creator.
Complex ideas don't sort of work in little pieces. I mean, if you take what's going on at CERN, for example, with the Large Hadron Collider, and they're hoping to discover the Higgs particle, it's not going to be the case that somebody's going to go, "Oh, look, there's a Higgs particle," in the way that you might say, "Oh, look, there's an elephant," if an elephant walked into the room. And if somebody said, "Well, I don't really believe in any of this standard model stuff. I don't even believe there's such a thing as elementary particles or bosons or Higgs particles," you know, and you were asked to prove each little piece of it, you actually wouldn't be able to. What the reason we believe in the standard model is not because people have done one experiment which showed that there are electrons, and one that showed that protons, and one that showed neutrons, and one that showed this, that, and the other. I mean, some of that is sort of in the historical past, but it's because you put all this stuff together into a rather complicated and intricate model with extremely surprising properties, but nevertheless it makes sense of a whole series of observations which all otherwise seem rather bizarre and strange. Now, you could find a conceivable alternative explanation for absolutely any physics experiment that you could do, and of course there are these string theorists who are working, doing some incredibly beautiful mathematics for something that's entirely beyond the standard model. But nevertheless, the standard model is extremely well-motivated belief. Now, of course, God isn't an object you can do experiments on. Theology will always be more complicated and less full of mathematics than physics. But nevertheless, you can't really say, well, this bit of this theological worldview supported by that and this bit supported by the other, and sort of take them in pieces. You want to take them as a whole. And if you're prepared to entertain the hypothesis of a loving ultimate creator, which makes sense of anthropic fine-tuning in a way that an ultimate creator would not, consider, for example, somebody producing a simulated universe on a computer. You know, they might make a simulated universe in which there, you know, it was just, for many reasons, utterly horrible. They might actually hate their characters. Sometimes you suspect certain novelists of hating the characters that they produce, or playwrights of hating their characters. So what we're saying is not just merely that there is some kind of creator, but in a sense that it's a loving ultimate creator. And once you allow the possibility for that idea, then all kinds of other things start to make sense, like love involves a certain level of communication. a level of communication which is enough that people can respond to it, but not so heavy that they've got no choice, because, you know, free will and choice are an essential part of love. So I agree with you that the anthropic fine-tuning on its own supports a loving ultimate creator, but could conceivably support some other forms of ultimate creator. But once you believe in a loving ultimate creator, you've gone a long way further than deism.
Yeah, that's true. But I think what, you know, you alluded to a problem, which is, again, not only is deism one of the interpretations, arguably a better interpretation is that kind of author who doesn't love his or her creation. Because if you actually look at the way in which the universe has been designed, you know, the way in which nature works and so forth, we see a universe which is, you know, full of suffering, pain, parasites that eat people's eyes out from the inside. Yeah, I think all really, really, really quite horrible, grotesque things. So now, I understand that you can come back with me for an answer for this, absolutely, because, as you say, when you put things in together, you create a complete worldview. As an intelligent, thoughtful Christian with a scientific knowledge, you create a worldview in which all these things are harmonised. It's always possible to make these things consistent. The question I would have, though, is, you know, we have to then try our best to ask, what would someone who is not motivated to interpret the evidence in one way or another, what would be the most likely explanation they would see? And I think it's very hard for me to see how any kind of, like, you know, a Martian, an anthropologist, for example, who just discovers this science for the first time, would look upon the way the universe actually functions and say, ah, now that really looks like the work of a loving creator. It seems to be the work of an indifferent creator at best, and a slightly sadistic one at worst, to be honest.
What do you make of that, Nicholas? Because I had a discussion on similar lines with an atheist not long ago who said that, you know, if you look at the way the world is and the way the universe is, you know, without having our preconceptions, what is the most likely explanation that there is a loving God behind it, or that there is no God behind it, or something else? And this is a similar argument. And then I had a brief chat with Richard Dawkins once about the fine tuning as well, and he again was very sort of in the way that you are, Julian, keen to say it's very well when, you know, theologians are talking about the Big Bang and scientific things and a deist God, but then to sort of lay all this stuff on about a Trinitarian God and all that stuff, it's a complete leap into a whole other realm. I mean, can you get there from what you're talking about, or is it ultimately about what you believe to start with, Nicholas, and you are essentially harmonising all the different data that come at you and running it through your theological filter so that you get the God that you worship out at the other end?
Well, there's a little bit in both of those points of view. I mean, just as when you're doing science, you take the information through a whole set of presuppositions and indeed apparatus which is built around these presuppositions. On the other hand, I think the really crucial step is going from some kind of ultimate creator to a loving ultimate creator. Once you've got to a loving ultimate creator, then in some sense the doctrine of the Trinity is working out the implications of this in a little bit the same way as the Standard Model was. John Polkinghorne's got another very nice book called Quantum Physics and Theology, An Unexpected Kinship, where he compares the way in which the physics community reacted to this very surprising and hard to interpret experimental data about particles being sometimes acting like particles, sometimes like waves, and so on and so forth, and the way in which the Christian theological community reacted to this very difficult to understand data about, you know, Jesus and his resurrection appearances, and sometimes you can sort of see him and sometimes you can't, and then you know, the Holy Spirit and what is the Holy Spirit, and you see the same kind of reacting to puzzling phenomena and then getting some kind of framework that makes sense of them. I agree with you absolutely that the problem of suffering and evil is a very serious one. And we were talking earlier about one of the great gifts of science to theology being this whole business of evolution. You know, you might well imagine that it would be an easy matter to create a universe in which there was a lot less suffering. You know, why is there pain and suffering in the universe? Well, from the moment you start with the idea that evolution is an essential aspect of how you're going to create life with true freedom, then you have to have pain, suffering and death for evolution to occur. Sorry, you have to pretty much have to have death for evolution to occur. If you don't have pain and suffering, you will not have learning creatures. You know, we suffer, our pain receptors are there to protect us from harm. Harm exists in the universe because that is an essential consequence of the outworking of the laws of physics and biology. And if it's true, as the current understanding of science shows, that there's a very narrow window of laws and constants which allow the emergence of any form of life at all, then it's far from clear that, you know, yes, oh, if we were God, we'd have twiddled some knobs differently and we'd have come up with a universe which has got a lot less suffering. Of course, one of the questions that raises is then is, even if the loving ultimate creator has created a universe with this much suffering for good reasons, is he just a passive spectator? And of course, it's one of the unique ideas in Christian theology, as opposed to other theologies, that this loving ultimate creator is not just a passive spectator, has actually, in this extraordinary sense, come and taken this suffering and pain on themselves. And you may well say, well, since he at some level is ultimately responsible for the existence of this pain and suffering, that's not a totally unreasonable thing to do. Which, at one level, I don't want to sound heterodox there, but in a sense, I agree with you. I think a God who simply watched all this pain and suffering and wasn't prepared to do anything about it, and was only just prepared to let other beloved entities suffer, but not take the suffering on themselves, would be not terribly loving. Now, how, just as this apparently impossible paradox, how a creator could create free creatures, you also have this apparently impossible paradox, how a creator who's outside the universe can take the suffering on himself. And one of the remarkable things about Christian theology, and one of the things that you know, has this sort of ring of truth about it, at least for me, is that these two extraordinary paradoxes do turn out to have solutions. And when you see, you think, wow, that's amazing, because you could never have thought of that a priori.
Well, can I just sort of probe you a bit, though, on this connection, as you say, once you go from an ultimate creator to a loving ultimate creator? So I think the place of science in making that journey, I think, should be made plainer. I actually don't agree what it is. You see, I can see how you might think that things like anthropic fine-tuning are part of the case for believing there is an ultimate creator. But I would imagine that your reasons for thinking there is a loving ultimate creator are generally quite different. They're more to do with your own personal experience of God's grace, whatever it might be, and so forth. And that's what enables you to get from the ultimate creator to the loving ultimate creator. Once you're there, you can then see various things about the way the universe is, evolution and so forth, as being consistent with that. But I think what I still want to resist is the sense that looking at those things in themselves, just looking, you know, without a commitment on either side about whether there's a loving ultimate creator or not, could possibly lead you to conclude that there was. You need to have got your conception of the loving aspect of the God from somewhere else, I think. And I'm not saying this, I'm saying this not as we're trying to catch you out, because there are plenty of people, I think a lot of people, my colleague Jeremy Stangram interviewed Russell Stannard, the physicist, for example. And, you know, actually, at the end of the day, he says quite openly that, you know, he's very interested in the extent to which science supports or doesn't support religious belief, but ultimately, that's not the basis of his belief. He knows God exists. And why does he know? Because God is real to him. So I think it is quite important that people know the place science has in all of this, because I think there is a danger that when people are reading about the wonderful ways in which science and religion can be brought together, they inevitably end up getting, I think, the false belief that somehow the science is the thing that's pushing you towards the religion. And I think that's generally, as a matter of fact, not the case for most Christians.
For me, as a layperson in this regard, to some extent. One way that I see it is that the science, in terms of the physics, the gaps, if that's what we're calling them, and you're saying we're plugging a god into those gaps, if we say that it was God who did the fine tuning sort of thing, the gaps are getting bigger. They're getting sort of harder to explain. Now that perhaps is not a good reason for saying, therefore God done it, but that, if you like, it's crying out for an explanation. Now the problem is that haven't we got to the boundaries at this point of where we, how we're going to explain anything? Because if we start positing multiverses, etc., I mean, that is just a huge leap of faith on the part of someone who has to have a different explanation to God, isn't it?
But I think this then goes back to the case of human imagination, you know? I mean, yeah, sure, to me, the idea that there are trillions of universes...
Oh, far more, far, far more.
Far, far more than that. It sounds utterly implausible, but why should that be a limit on what is the case? You know, we basically have no idea. I mean, when it comes to assessing probabilities, we have to recognise that humans are very bad at this. I'll give you a small, quick example. You know, if a person wins the lottery, 14 million to one chance. Now, a lot of people, if they win the lottery, they feel so improbable that I won it, 14 million to one. There must be some reason. But, of course, we know that's not the case. We know that if you run a lottery and there are 14 million tickets sold, then it's likely one person will win. It will be purely random. In other words, unless you know what the initial conditions were, how many times the dice was rolled and so forth, the improbability of something happening, no matter how large, is no reason to suppose that you need some outside purposeful explanation for it. In the same way, we're just whistling in the dark at the moment about the improbabilities of this universe, because we have no idea about what kind of initial conditions the emergence of this world came out of. It may be the case that we'll come up with some understanding of, you know, where the universe came from, whereby even on the apparently astronomical odds that we have now, it was we're probably several universes with life in them, in the same way that, and that will seem baffling only in the same way that it seems baffling to someone who's won a lottery where 14 million to one chance.
Well, as Parley said, no credits for the future.
No.
But this does bring to another aspect of the connection, the sort of meta-scientific connection of a loving ultimate creator, which is the extraordinary ability that humans have to understand these kinds of questions. Now, as you say, it may be that some of this is just going to be too difficult for humans to understand ever, but we can understand the physics of what's going on in stars that are millions of light years away. Now, that itself clearly has no conceivable evolutionary survival value. You know, our ability to, as it were, dodge saber-toothed tigers might have evolved in a purely straightforward way, but our ability to make calculations about incredibly distant stars is a remarkable fact about the relationship between the universe and our minds. And this makes perfect sense if there's a loving ultimate creator who has actually wants us to understand the principles on which he has created the universe. And it's one of the reasons why historically an awful lot of modern science was developed by Christians rather than, say, the much richer cultures in India and China, which didn't have this concept of a loving ultimate creator who, quotes, creates man in their own image.
I'm a little bit confused by what you said there, because you seem to be suggesting that the fact that we can understand things at all is some kind of evidence for the fact that of divine grace, and that because there's no particular evolutionary reason why we should have that. But so you accept the fact that evolution is the mechanism by which the Creator God gave us life. So it must be possible, on your own beliefs, for our capacity to understand to be purely a product of evolution.
What's strange is that the laws of nature are in a form that our evolved brains can understand. You could imagine the possibility of a universe with laws that were completely inaccessible to human beings. I mean, probably ants' brains simply cannot understand the laws of physics, even if they were written down on an ant heap or whatever. Maybe dogs can't. Darwin famously talked about the difficulty of a dog understanding the mind of Newton and compared that to difficulty of human beings understanding the mind of God. So there is something strange about the fact that human understanding is sufficient to probe, apparently with extraordinary accuracy, very, very distant and surprising events.
Is there something else in that which I've heard some Christian mathematicians, etc., say, that the very fact that the laws which we have discovered are so incredibly regular, so incredibly, if you like, symmetrical, that we can put them into these incredible equations, that they are discoverable in that sense and that they have this symmetry, is again an argument for the fact that we live in a universe which appears to want us to understand it almost. It was under no obligation for these rule for the laws of physics to be so incredibly symmetrical and allow us to make incredible calculations.
There is this remarkable concept of mathematical beauty, which is very difficult to explain to someone who isn't a mathematician, but is very obvious to mathematicians. Why should the human understanding of mathematical beauty have anything to do with what really goes on out there in the distant stars? You can say that's a complete coincidence, or you can... But if there is a loving ultimate creator, that's explicable. Otherwise, frankly, it's inexplicable.
We're returning again to this idea that things which seem remarkable to us and uncanny and everything, it points to the creator God, doesn't it? I mean, it's not surprising that certain things about the world and us are uncanny, surprising, fortunate, and so forth. And actually, I can imagine why they're. I can imagine naturalistic explanations for both those things, both the fact that we can explain the universe and the fact that our idea of beauty is somehow connected to the natural order of things. Time and again, you see, human beings, where they see something which is uncanny or so forth, they always seem to take that as being a sign of agency. You know, we have a real difficulty in accepting
isn't
the fact
that just because most of the time it is a sign of agency.
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, take bumping into someone you've just been thinking about, for example. You know, there's no problem at all in explaining why those things happen on entirely random basis. But people find that very hard to accept. They think, oh, there must be a reason for that. Coincidences. People have it real difficulty understanding that coincidences are bound to happen all the time. So, you know, I just think we're just too quick to jump. We have this is where the brain, actually, everything about evolution hasn't particularly helped us, because it seems that human intelligence has evolved, for reasons we can explain, I think, to jump to conclusions about coincidences, because we're order-seeking animals, yeah, basically. So we see a certain element of order, we assume some kind of intention behind it. Because on the whole, it serves us quite well to go around with that assumption.
Exactly. Yeah,
on the whole, if we see more patterns than there really are there, than fewer patterns, we're going to do better, right? It doesn't harm us if we think that it's important whether or not we do a little dance before we sow our plants. It is important that we recognise we have to water them. So if you see two patterns, the need to do a little dance and the need to water the plants, you're going to do better than if you see not enough patterns and you neither do the dance nor water them. Now, the truth only requires one of those patterns to be true. Okay, and I think we have to be very suspicious of when we take a look at the world, we see a pattern, and we find ourselves almost instinctively wanting to attribute some significance to that pattern.
We're going to have to draw things to a close, gentlemen, and I'll ask you just to 30 seconds summing up while I just give out a message, which is that if you're listening and you'd like more information, I do encourage you to get hold of a copy of Questions of Truth, 51 Responses to Questions About God, Science and Belief. It's by John Polkinghorne and Nicholas Beale. And if you go to Julian's website, would you like to give us that, Julian?
Yeah, it's just julianbagini.com.
You will be able to access his review of the book as well, and some very interesting discussions that have been going on at the website there as well, on the blog. So you've been listening to an edition of Unbelievable, looking at these questions of God, science and belief. If you'd like to interact yourself and get back to me on this, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can equally phone and leave me a voicemail message on 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. And I'll be starting a discussion on this at the Premier community as normal. So do check that out by visiting the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. This programme there is a podcast now and many others besides. So do check that out, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Just time for a quick summing up, gentlemen. And perhaps, Julian, would you want to give us your final thoughts as we close?
Well, I will be brief. I think that people who should read this book, if they doubt it is possible for science and religion to be compatible, because I think it will show them that it is. What I think it won't show is that science makes religious belief more likely or more probable.
OK. And yours, Nicholas?
I think that we are faced with making choices. We have a worldview, whether we like it or not. Everyone has a worldview, like everyone speaks prose. And the science doesn't force you to take a Christian worldview. I think we both agree about that. It certainly doesn't force you to take an atheist worldview. What it does show is that there are some deep questions about reality which, from a Christian worldview, make sense. From an atheist worldview, they may just be bizarre coincidences. It's always possible that they're bizarre coincidences, but it's also possible that there's a loving ultimate creator behind this.
Thank you, gentlemen, both, for being with me on the programme today. I hope you've enjoyed listening. Do get your responses into me here on the programme, and I look forward to your company again at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
Do join me as David Robertson, Christian pastor and author of The Dawkins Letters, looks at atheist myths. He says there are various atheist myths represented by the likes of Richard Dawkins. He'll be chatting with another atheist, Adrian Hayter, about those. Do join me for that between 2.30 and 4 next week and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.